case number 12-7092, Denise M. Clark, appellant v. Better, Simo, and Bard, PC, et al. Mr. Bruce for the appellant, Ms. Ehrenberg for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Bruce, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case, this appeal, concerns unpaid retirement benefits from a small professional service corporation. Small professional service corporations are not covered by the PBGC insurance scheme, and they don't have the PBGC coming in to help enforce obligations to the plan. There's a 25-person limit where if a professional service corporation is above 25 active participants, it is covered by the PBGC system of insurance. But if it's not, if it doesn't meet that threshold, it is an uninsured plan. And since 1986, that doesn't just make a difference in whether people's benefits are guaranteed. It also makes a difference in whether unfunded benefit obligations are paid and collected by the PBGC on behalf of the plan. As a result, at the termination of this plan, without the PBGC insurance, 14 people only received 53% of their accrued benefits. Ms. Clark, the plaintiff, actually received even less because the plan's benefit obligations were improperly interpreted for her alone, so that she only received 38% of the accrued benefits that she should have received. For participants like Ms. Clark, there aren't the same PBGC protections, but there are certain protections which we tried to enforce here. First of all, there's a duty to follow the plan terms and to follow those plan terms according to their plain meaning and consistently with the application of those terms to other participants. Secondly, there's a long-standing regulation by the Treasury Department that's designed to prevent preferential payments from being made to owners before a plan is terminated, so that all the money doesn't go out the door before to the owner before the termination, and then at the termination the other people are left holding the bag. That regulation was first promulgated in 1960, and it is incorporated in ERISA specifically for plans that are not insured by the PBGC, and that's by virtue of ERISA Section 403(d)(1). Third, there's a requirement in ERISA Section 402(b)(1) that every plan have a funding policy and that funding policy be stated in the plan. Here, the funding policy stated in the plan was to maintain the plan on a sound actuarial basis, which the firm's founder testified meant fully funding the plan. But after Ms. Clark left the firm and the defendants were running the firm and the plan's funding deteriorated. It went down to where we wound up with the results that we have here, where people were receiving 53% of the benefits. That started happening in 2002, the plan terminated in 2005. The defendants took no actions to remedy that underfunding. It had dropped from close to 100% down to 55%. They took no actions. The fourth protection in ERISA is that there's an anti-cutback rule, and there's a regulation to enforce that rule which says that the rule protects against not only changes from an amendment in the course of operating the plan, but also changes in accrued benefits as a result of a plan termination. And here, when the plan was terminated, that triggered a limitation of liability provision where that 47% of the plan's benefits that was unpaid, that as soon as the plan terminated, the plan sponsor, the firm, had no responsibility whatsoever to cover those benefits. That limitation of liability provision triggered by a termination amendment violates the anti-cutback rule.
So Mr. Bruce, you made all these arguments in the district court. You have a comprehensive decision from the district court. Which one of these arguments do you think is your strongest case?
I think that they're all strong. I think that, but let me take them in order, because the two regulatory questions were decided before trial. And the first one is the termination restrictions. There was $611,000 that went out the door in violation of those regulations. The district court's decision said that tax regulations standing alone are not enforceable under ERISA. But these regulations are not standing alone. They're incorporated in ERISA.
Isn't that what all the other circuits have also held and have looked at this question?
No. They hold that in terms of tax requirements that are not incorporated in ERISA. But there are many cases enforcing tax requirements that are incorporated in either ERISA or the terms of the plan. We cited some of the partial termination cases. The partial termination rules are not in ERISA, but they are incorporated in plan terms because the IRS requires them to be in plan terms. So there are no cases saying that when Congress adopts a Treasury regulation, when it puts it into the system of regulation in ERISA, that's not enforceable by a participant. I mean, obviously, Congress has the authority to do that, and it did that here for plans that are not insured by ERISA. It put in a specific reference to make sure that those rules were included in the allocation of plan assets. Those rules would have protected Ms. Clark and the other participants. On the anti-cutback rule, our main argument is based on the environmental defense versus Duke Energy case from the Supreme Court. And we think what the district court did there was it trimmed back or modified the Treasury regulation. The Treasury regulation says that changes resulting from plan termination are subject to the anti-cutback rule. And what the district court said was there not only has to be the termination amendment, but the other plan terms have to be changed so that when this termination amendment was adopted, it invoked a limitation of liability provision that was already in the plan. And the court is saying that we had to have that limitation of liability provision also had to be new. And we're saying that that's a two-amendment rule that's not required by the Treasury regulations and that the district court does not have the authority to effectively invalidate part of the regulation based on its own analysis or policy preferences or whatever. And that's what the Supreme Court decision in the environmental defense case established.
Let me ask you, mm-hmm. in your reply brief on page 28, where you're talking about an actual amendment?
Yes.
What are you referring to?
The actual amendment here is in the joint appendix at JA 2385 and 2387. There were two versions of a written resolution to terminate the plan, and the court agreed with us that that was an amendment subject to the anti-cutback regulation, the anti-cutback rule. So where the court parted ways with us is by saying that there had to be a second amendment, and we're saying that that's not what the regulations provide. And you know, this is one of the few protections that people in these small uninsured plans have, is that the plan can't be terminated and the employer just walks away from the obligations. We don't know whether the employer here could have paid for some of those obligations or paid for a lot of them. But in some cases, if the district court's theory was correct, an employer that had, you know, millions of dollars could walk away just by the stroke of a pen signing a termination amendment. And that's what the anti-cutback rule was designed to prevent, and that's what the Treasury Department made even more specific in its regulations. If I can talk about the improper grouping claim. The improper grouping claim is the claim that's unique to Ms. Clark, and that refers to a 20% credit that was in the plan for Class A shareholders who were born after 1950. There were only three such people, Ms. Clark and the two defendants, Mr. Simo and Mr. Bard. Those are the only three people who satisfy that language, and there's no question that Ms. Clark satisfies it just as much as Mr. Bard and Mr. Simo satisfy it. But they denied her any credit on the basis that she should get a 10% credit, because they said, well, even though the 20% credit was perfectly unambiguous, that there was a subsequent
provision. Can I interrupt you and just ask you a question about that?
Yes.
Under the Third Amendment plan, she could be in Class B or C, right? Isn't that the origin of the problem here?
That was their theory.
But isn't that?
But that theory never applied to Mr. Bard or Mr. Simo.
No, it applied to your client, correct?
And that's what we're saying, Your Honor.
But isn't it true that under the Third Amendment, she did fit into both classes? She could have been in either one, correct?
It's a basic contract construction principle that if you have a list like that where someone is included in the 20% classification and then you come down to the 10% and they could be included in that, you say, you know, of course they're included in the 20%. It's poor drafting and that's in fact what the defendants described it as. They admitted it was just poor drafting.
And the district court credited their testimony, didn't they, that they thought she was in C, not B?
No.
No?
No.
What did he credit then?
He credited the defendant's testimony that not until this was all over were they aware of this problem. That's what he credited.
The defendants were both in the 20% classification.
No, what he credited, as I understand it, was their testimony that they didn't understand, they were unaware of this discrepancy until after the plan termination. That is, that there was some question as to whether your client should have been B rather than C.
No.
And that they were treated differently.
No.
No?
No. Before the assets were distributed, they knew that Ms. Clark was claiming that she should have 20% credits for the last 3 years of her employment. And we learned in discovery that there were even calculations made by the plan's actuary of Ms. Clark's benefits with the 20% credits. What they claimed they did not know was, and Mr. Simo obviously knew that he was receiving 20% credits. What they claimed they did not know was that Mr. Bard had been receiving 20% credits.
Wasn't that just for 1 year?
His employment.
Yes, Judge Griffith has a question.
I'm sorry, wasn't Mr. Bard treated differently for 1 year only? For 2002?
For 2 years, Your Honor.
For 2 years. And Mr. Simo was treated differently, wasn't he, because there was a merger agreement that required that he be treated, that he be put in the 20% category. Isn't that right?
The merger agreement is what...
Isn't that right, that there was a merger agreement that said he needed to be put in the 20%?
The merger agreement is what instigated the Third Amendment. So the merger agreement said that Mr. Simo was to, there was to be a 20% classification. So the Third Amendment was then drafted as a result of that merger agreement, saying that all participants who are Class A shareholders and born after 1950 are in the 20% classification. That same amendment had the, what they now say is the ambiguity about the 10% classification. But that same ambiguity would apply to Mr. Simo. So the plan, the amendment from the inception was interpreted in accordance with what are basic rules that obviously if someone is unambiguously in a better category, that's the category they should be in. And that the subsequent category applies to everyone else. That's the way it was interpreted for Mr. Simo. And then there was apparently a mistake where Mr. Clark and or Ms. Clark and Mr. Bard were left in the 10% category temporarily, and then that was corrected for Mr. Bard, again, with no problem based on that 10% classification. They just didn't go back and correct it all the way.
I know, but isn't Judge Griffith correct by saying Mr. Simo was protected by the merger agreement provision?
No. Once the plan document has to provide Mr. Simo's benefits. If it did not do that, I suppose he could sue for breach of contract. But the plan document has to supply the terms.
Right.
And you can't have extrinsic evidence for just one individual.
As I understood it, the merger agreement was basically, I agree to merge my firm with the firm for which Mrs. Clark was working at the time.
Right.
Provided, and it's that proviso that protects Mr. Simo, and that was included in the plan in this category.
That's what led to the language. And then so once the language is in the plan, it has to be interpreted consistently for everybody. You can't go back and say, oh, well, there was some extrinsic evidence, and therefore, you know, Mr. Simo has a special rule. The language says all participants who are Class A shareholders are born after 1950. That has to include not only Mr. Simo, but Mr. Bard and Ms. Clark. It's a basic principle of ERISA on, you know, that, and that was really the principle that was used in the Wagoner case, is that provisions have to be interpreted consistently.
But in Wagoner, there were other provisions that helped guide that interpretation. Here, it's just plain out ambiguous. The only thing that could contribute to the interpretation of the third amended plan is the restatement, which itself said it wasn't retroactive.
Your Honor, I think if I can go to the premise that if I'm in something where it says that I'm eligible for a 20% benefit, and that's perfectly unambiguous, and then there's something about I may also be eligible for a 10% benefit. The only question for me is, am I going to get 30% or 20%? There's no way to ratchet me back to 10% when I've got an unambiguous...
Well, then why did the restatement feel the need to correct this non-ambiguity?
That's how he treated it, was that he said he didn't even need permission because he knew that was what, it was just poor drafting. So poor drafting can't be elevated to block one person from benefits.
Poor drafting is usually the source of ambiguity.
But I tell you, there's an unambiguous provision providing the 20%. You can't take some poor drafting of some lesser provision and say that that's popping up to modify the 20% rule.
No, not modifying it, just creating an ambiguity.
It's leaving it of no effect, Your Honor, and that is...
Well, one of the two provisions can't be effective. At least that's a one reading of it. You could read it the way you are, or you could read it the way the parties did, which is there's an ambiguity.
They never read it that way, Your Honor. The district court twice found that there was not a fully considered or reasoned interpretation of the language.
Let me go back to just the question I was asking about what the district court credited. My notes say that after the district court heard all the testimony, he found that Mr. Solo and Mr. Bard had no reason to suspect that Bard had in fact been treated differently for one of those 3 years than Ms. Clark. And he credited that testimony. Is that wrong?
They didn't do any inquiry.
He said...
They never...
You didn't answer my question. I asked you whether you disagree with me that as I read this, the district court heard their testimony and credited that testimony, that they didn't know.
That they didn't know, not... Your statement was that they had no reason to know.
Right.
That he credited that they did not, in fact, know that, but they didn't make any inquiries, and that's a basic responsibility of a fiduciary. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Fine, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for Eppley.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Jason Ehrenberg, and I represent the appellees in this matter. I think both of you, Judge, the judges that are sitting in front of me that I can see, got the issue right, which is that Judge Bates credited the testimony of my clients and found incredible the testimony of Ms. Clark on several points. The majority of the issues that are the subject of this appeal were issues that were decided by Judge Bates in an approximately 60-page, well-reasoned decision that followed a six-day bench trial. At the bench trial, unlike on summary judgment, Judge Bates didn't have to view the facts in the light most favorable to Ms. Clark. And at the bench trial, Judge Bates, viewing the facts as he saw fit, credited the testimony of my clients, the majority of the testimony of the plan's attorney, Mr. Ansbach, the majority of the testimony of the plan's actuary, Mr. Reddington, the testimony of Mr. Nielsen, who was no longer at the firm but was part of the benefits process, and the testimony of both experts. I think he actually was very clear that he kind of weighed the testimony and wasn't that persuaded by either.
But he also said that he was bothered by the difference in the treatment between Mr. Bard and Ms. Clark, and I am too. What's the answer to that? Why was Mr. Bard treated more favorably?
Well, as Judge Bates found, and as was just discussed right before I stood up, there was this ambiguity. The ambiguity was recognized during the benefits appeal process, and it was addressed.
But the ambiguity applied to both Mr. Bard and Ms. Clark. Why was he treated more favorably than she was?
Well,
same language. Now, Mr. Seema, I think, is a much different case because of the merger agreement. But what's the justification for treating Mr. Bard more favorably than Ms. Clark?
I think the justification, as Judge Bates found, and I don't want to rewrite the facts. I want to go with what Judge Bates found. Judge Bates found that, in fact, there had not been differential treatment, that my clients did not know that anyone had been treated differently, that they believed that Mr. Bard and Ms. Clark were being treated similarly.
But they were treated differently.
Yeah.
That's the point of Judge Griffith's question. They were, in fact, treated differently, correct?
After the decision was made and during the course of this litigation, Mr. Bard and Mr. Simo learned that, in fact, there had been differential treatment. And Judge Bates credited their testimony that they were not aware at the time.
Next step, therefore what?
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Therefore what? That they had no obligation to look further or that they should have known?
Well, I don't believe that. Yeah. Judge Bates did not find that they should have known. Right. Judge Bates did not find that they should have retroactively, during the course of an active litigation, several years after a plan had terminated, go back and change something. I think what Judge Bates said was at the time the decisions were made, it was their understanding that Ms. Clark and Mr. Bard were being treated the same way, and that Mr. Bard was actually taking a position that was inconsistent with his own best interest, which would have been for him to be treated more favorably. So the evidence is very clear on that point. And I think on this benefit point, the one issue I want to raise is that...
What I guess we're struggling with is the notion that they didn't know. They were trustees of the plan. They thought Mrs. Clark and Mr. Bard were being treated similarly. When they discovered their mistake, no obligation to do anything about it?
Well, and that's my point. When did they discover the mistake? The testimony at trial and what Judge Bates...
Well, she challenged.
But she did not challenge that they had been treated differently. She did not say, contrary to what opposing counsel has said, that I need to be in this category.
I thought she did.
She simply inquired during the administrative process of the percentage that had been applied to her. She was told of the percentage that had been applied. She was told for this year 8%, for these years 10%. And at no point during the administrative process did she or her counsel, who was involved in the administrative process, say to Mr. Simo or Mr. Bard, no, she needs to be in 20%. And so Mr. Bard and Mr. Simo made the determination along with Mr. Ansbach and along with the input of others. The judge said someone with a fresh set of eyes because they wanted to make sure they were getting this right. They said, well, if Ms. Clark's in the 10% category, Mr. Bard's in the 10% category, then that's correct. And there is an ambiguity, and arguably Mr. Bard could be in 20, and arguably Ms. Clark could be in 20, but we're going to keep them in 10. And Mr. Bard was one of the decision makers.
Do you have an explanation for why Mr. Bard was kept in the 20% for the 1 or 2 years?
Well, the explanation is that the plan's actuary, post-termination of the plan, made an adjustment, and it showed that Mr. Bard had, in fact, been credited with the 20%. And that was not something that was learned until Mr. Bard.
I understand that. I understand that the primary issue here is knowledge. But do you have an explanation for why the disparity ever occurred?
Well, no. I mean, I think what Judge Bates found was that the disparity occurred because the actuary had placed Mr. Bard into 20%, even though the directive had been for Mr. Bard and Ms. Clark to be treated the same way. And I think... the question you ask is a good one. Why? ERISA does not require under either for a benefit claim, which is really what we're talking about. ERISA doesn't require that the decision be correct. ERISA requires that the decision be reasonable. And what Judge Bates found in this decision, contrary to what the other side has said, Judge Bates analyzed this grouping issue under both an A1B benefit claim standard and under an A3 fiduciary, prudent fiduciary standard. Under A1B, he cited to the Wagner decision from this court and the Firestone decision and said it's an abuse of discretion or sometimes called arbitrary and capricious standard. And it's, as this court said in Wagner, that it's a reasonableness determination. And he looked at the decision-making process and he did it at trial, not having to view the facts in the light most favorable to Ms. Clark, and he came to the conclusion that even weighing the conflict of interest from the MetLife v. Glenn case that Mr. Simo may have had, He credited that potential conflict, and he said, I still find that the decision was reasonable. And then he went and he looked at it under A3, and he said, I'm going to look at this under a prudent fiduciary standard. And Judge Bates said, I find that similarly situated people with like skills and a like capacity would have come or could have come to the same conclusion that my clients came to. And so whether or not the rationale is perfect.
The conclusion that your clients came to.
With regard to Ms. Clark's grouping.
They didn't know?
No, the conclusion that Ms. Clark should be treated
just
in
like
the 10%.
Bard.
Correct. And so he found that they came to the conclusion and reached the conclusion as to her claim, and it was reasonable under either a fiduciary standard or under an
so
A1B.
So Mr. Barr just got a windfall?
I don't believe that's the case. And again, I'm not here to defend my client's actions. I'm
well,
here.
Isn't your answer to that? He did, but it makes no difference
that's
in this case, right?
I'm sorry?
That's
he did, but it makes. But your theory is it makes no difference in this case.
No, I don't believe he received a windfall. I believe he was treated, at the end of the day, it was learned that he was treated differently. I personally believe that there's justification for the differential treatment.
Okay, but
because
your point is that even if he was treated differently, and even if there was no justification,
no,
that's not the question the district court was required to answer, correct?
No, I think that the evidence we presented to the district court that was that there was a justification for differential treatment, and that justification being that the 2000, the operative amendment, which clarified the ambiguity, was not applicable to Ms. Clark because she had already left the plan.
Okay, but that's not what the district court ordered. Right, I mean,
that's right.
That's why I thought your answer to Judge Rogers' question would have been, yeah, even assuming there was no justification for it, there's no remedy here because the question is whether the fiduciaries acted reasonably based on the information they had, correct?
That's correct.
Yes, at the time, and the district court credited their testimony that they didn't know. So
that's correct.
So basically, this act cannot be used to correct the kind of injustice that the plaintiff has identified. Is that right?
To the extent there's an injustice, yes.
Right. That's your theory. That's your position, right?
My
position. I understand your backup position that the treatment, different treatment, was justified.
Right.
But that isn't what the district court found.
Right. I think the district court did address the ambiguity in that the restatement did not apply or arguably would not apply to Ms. Clark. But yes, the answer is that's the decision that was reached. And again, the issue isn't what was the decision about Mr. Barr. The issue was the decision with regard to Ms. Clark reasonable?
Yeah.
Not was the decision about Mr. Barr reasonable. Mr. Barr hasn't brought a benefit claim in this case. But
I just want to make sure. So your position is, and this is what I understood the district court to say, that the question in a case like this isn't whether the differential treatment was justified. The question is whether the fiduciaries, based on all the information they had at the time, acted reasonably, correct?
That's correct.
And so if they did, a proceeding like this can't be used to correct what might well be an obvious error in the differential treatment of these two people, correct?
Arguably, because Judge...
I'm not asking you for a concession about it. I'm
not trying to make a concession,
okay.
But the confusion...
No, I'm not asking for one.
The confusion is that Judge Bates allowed the plaintiff to bring the grouping claim as an A3 claim, which is a fiduciary claim.
Correct.
Where you're not limited to the administrative record. You're allowed to bring in other information.
Right.
And so Judge Bates did consider information... Or the understanding of my clients based upon what was in front of them at the time. And he did find that with that further information, he did not believe they breached a fiduciary duty.
Right. Even though there might have been inappropriate differential treatment, correct?
Even though there was differential treatment.
Does your case turn on... Can you only win if we agree with you that the differential treatment was justified?
No.
That's what I thought.
Right.
So the question is that if the fiduciaries acted reasonably based on all the information that they had at the time, then the district court is correct, even if the differential treatment of the two was unjustified. Correct?
I would believe that's correct.
Okay.
And I just want to qualify that I don't like the added word unjustified. I just think if it wasn't properly explained at the time. But I think you touched on the important point, which is that it's Judge Bates' decision that is at issue here, not the decision that Mr. Simo and Mr. Bard made. Was Judge Bates' factual finding, were those clearly erroneous? And on that point, we note that the other side has a lot of discussion in their brief about the facts, but they don't really point to a specific fact in particular that was clearly erroneous, a factual finding. They just note their general disagreement with the outcome. And again, on the issue of credibility, Judge Bates found over and over, and I point in particular the court to page 65 of the joint appendix, where Judge Bates in his decision found credible the large amount of testimony about these issues from my clients. Page 67, he found credible the testimony. In contrast, page 67 and 68 and throughout, he used terms like, I find it hard to believe, or I find it incredible, or I find that the argument strains credulity. And I think the fact that basically all of my time has been spent on what is today has been spent on a benefit claim really underscores the weakness of the other arguments. This was a plain vanilla benefit claim. The other side shifted course repeatedly throughout the litigation to keep it going. Judge Bates allowed them every opportunity to prove their case. At no point did they move for summary judgment on the benefit claim. At no point did Judge Bates have opportunity to view the facts prior to the trial in this matter in a light, putting both sides on even footing.
So and despite, can I ask you just a procedural question here? You said that Mrs. Clark, in her appeal, sought to find out how much she was paid. Is that correct?
She asked what percentage she had been placed in.
Right.
For the appropriate years, and she asked what...
So then she got that information.
Correct.
And then she files suit.
Correct.
And I need to be clear. Are you saying that the basis of her suit was simply a breach of fiduciary duty so that she could not obtain the actual monetary relief that she claimed she was entitled to in this litigation? And that's a distinct question from whether or not she convinced the district court. I just wanted to understand what she had to do to bring the issue properly before
she brought
the court.
Although she did not cabin her claim as a benefit claim,
she
brought it as a benefit claim.
And she was allowed to proceed.
And Judge Bates treated it, although he did say that I'm going to force the other, Ms. Clark, to pick either A1B or A3, mm-hmm. he did analyze this under both A1B and A3. And he found that under A1B, where she could arguably she could get the money if she won, under A1B she doesn't win. And he found that under A3, she doesn't win. And I believe the point you're raising with regard to A3, I do believe that she would have to show more than just that the decision was wrong. She would have to show that a reasonable person in like circumstances could not have reached their conclusion.
Right.
So
all right.
That's all I have, unless you have further questions.
Thank you. Judge Griffith, did you have a question?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel?
If I can say that Judge Bates in the summary judgment decisions recognized that there was no fully considered and reasoned interpretation of this plan language in the so-called administrative record from the defendants. He recognized that twice, and he specifically recognized it just saying that you found an ambiguity in a document doesn't answer the question of, well, what is the reasonable interpretation of this language? After, even after trial, there's still never been any presentation by the defendants where showing that following basic contract interpretation principles, you can have an unambiguous provision providing somebody with 20%. You can have some ambiguity in a subsidiary provision for 10%, and that can crop up to eliminate the 20% entitlement. There is no contract. The only contract theory that would lead to that is well, was the 20% of Scrivener's error? But otherwise, I mean, it is clear that, you know, if you substitute dollar amounts and it says Ms. Clark is entitled to $200 in one provision and later on it ambiguously says that she may be entitled to $100, that no one is going to interpret that $100 provision as voiding the $200 entitlement. And it, in fact, was never interpreted that way, even for either SEMO or Bard, or even in this litigation. And that is the requirement of this court's precedence in Wagoner, in Block versus Pitney Bowes, is a reasoned interpretation. The reasoned interpretation has to conform with plain language, contract interpretation principles, purpose, which obviously the purpose here was to provide Ms. Clark with a 20% credit, and it has to be interpreted consistently. And you can't come, what I think Judge Bates was saying in the final decision was he didn't find that these people acted in bad faith. But bad faith is not a requirement for a breach of fiduciary duty. He seemed to be suggesting that bad faith might be a requirement because there would be personal liability. And that simply is not the law. But that's his findings are, they're not that there was a reasoned interpretation. He's saying, I credit the story that they didn't have Mr. Bard's 20% calculation in front of them at the time that they made this thing. He didn't credit that they didn't search for it, that they didn't ask anybody for it. And in fact, in answer to Judge Griffith's question, the calculation of Mr. Bard's benefits is at JA 2461, and it shows the 20% calculation for 2 years. That was in existence. That was prepared at the same time as the calculations for Ms. Clark. There were also calculations for Mr. Simo showing the all 20%.
Thank you. Anything further? Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.